He said, "Matt, you know, we looked at everything and we need to do a biopsy because we're pretty sure it's a tumor." And I think my emotions were just so pissed off because I was about to go to Iowa. I liked Iowa. That was a fun track. Like, all I'm thinking is racing.
Oh
You know,
my
that's
God.
it.
So today on the podcast, we have Matt Tift. He's a former NASCAR Cup Series driver and a brain tumor survivor. He's currently living with epilepsy, and he's super open on this podcast about his struggles with his condition, about his dreams being, you know, taken away from him, his divorce, and weaning himself off of benzodiazepines. At 24, he became the youngest NASCAR Cup Series team owner. He's a thoughtful and driven individual. I really appreciate you guys listening. Enjoy.
Thanks for coming on, man. Appreciate you taking the time.
Absolutely. No, I've been watching a lot of your stuff. It's been cool to see what you're doing.
Yeah, it's fun. So with all my racers, I always want to go back to I guess like early kind of childhood and stuff. Paint the viewer or the listener a little bit of like what your childhood was like, where you grew up, what your dad or parents did for a living kind of thing.
Yeah, so I was born in Fairfax, Virginia, which is very confusing to people because they're like, "Oh, you're from Fairfax," and then people come up. No, I'm from Hinckley, Ohio. I lived there for like 3 months. So I'm not born in Cleveland, that area, but I was pretty much raised a Cleveland kid. So big Cleveland sports fan. It's a miserable feeling sometimes, but the as of today, the Browns had a good a week one, which is surprising. But that's you know, growing up in that area, I didn't have a really big racing background from like where I lived. But my dad, he grew up in Michigan, around the Mount Pleasant area. So they had a street stock. His name is Quentin, but they called him Chet the Jet. He raced a little bit, and he and a high school buddy, David Hilliker, they got a dirt late model together around 2001. My dad started owning the car, and so I was born in '96. So 5 years old, and my grandma lived up there, so I'm going up there for my birthday and Labor Day, watching dirt cars. And yeah, I'm always like, man, I'm gonna kind of go and get in a seat. But during that time period, my parents were building a company, so they did a lot of stuff in a lot of vaccine and different things overseas. So my mom, she went to the Peace Corps in Togo, Africa, and she actually got diagnosed with malaria 3 different times.
Oh.
Yeah, pretty rough. The last time she got it, you're supposed to spend like 2 years in the Peace Corps. She came back and she's working at the lab in the Smithsonian in DC. My dad was doing some cartography work for the government, and they end up meeting. And so my mom, she had this passion for wanting to go help and cure infectious diseases for third world countries. So not at all racing in that form. So kind of watched them build up their company from just the two of them in my bedroom. So it really expanded and grew it a lot, to where they were helping with Ebola. I think it was swine flu as well before that, the H1N1 stuff. And so a lot of medical backgrounds, what I grew up in. So, you know, racing for me was kind of a fun thing, but it wasn't ever a career path really. So growing up with my dad, going to the racetrack was fun. Loved it for my birthdays. And then I kind of got to being, you know, 9, 10 years old. I'm like, hey, when can I go do this?
Yeah, it's time, right? Like you know, by today's standards, I guess you started right around that time. That's kind of late, you know. How did
Which is
you
crazy.
convince them?
Yeah, it's crazy that we're in an age where being like, I didn't really start until I was 11 or 12. So I was super late to it. Whereas like now you're 5 and you're behind the 8 ball, which I don't think is a good thing really. But you have to, if you're going to do it, like you have the kid carts and the junior classes. But yeah, so my big thing was being around dirt tracks. I kept on saying like, I get into a Pinto or like, you know, some kid's class or something. And I found bandoleros and go-karts and stuff around me, and found this trial day at Barberton Speedway in Ohio. Went out, and the guy said, "Hey, that was one of the best trials we've ever had. Like, you should go, you know, and do this." My mom, being the businesswoman she was, she's like, "Hey, if you want to go do this, you got to write a proposal of what this is, why you're doing it, and where this could go." So I wrote a proposal, and then my 11th birthday, I was at Cedar Point, and they gave me a little envelope, and there's a picture of a cadet cart, I think it was, and from there was getting into go-karts, and he was 12, turning 13, after running go-karts for a little bit. Drove my first stock car in New Smyrna, Florida, at the Speedway down there, the Finish Line Driving School.
And the go-karts, were they like dirt oval, asphalt, road course? What kind of go-karts?
Yeah, all road course. So I did two cycle and four cycle, but everything was road course. I always wanted to go down the NASCAR route, but everything I did was road course. I don't know that there was a ton of oval stuff by me. Maybe there was, but the immediate path that we went and the people we knew is all it was all road course stuff.
Yeah, I mean, same with me. That was the only option here. That's what it was. I did the same thing as far as the jump to like a full size race car from a go-kart. That's quite a big jump.
It is. The biggest thing to me, I thought it was okay, like getting in the car and being by yourself. And then I remember my first race, it was like 2011, maybe 10, oh, 2010. I was at the Marshfield Speedway in Wisconsin, driving for Tim Schendel. And I remember practice, we were like first or second quick, like really good. And then got in the heat race, first time people on the track. Because I kind of practiced alone, like did that deal. And I remember like go-karts, it's a go-kart. Like it's not that big of a deal. Getting the race, I'm like, oh shit, like what is going on? Like just such a different sensation. Like you just feel, and being 12 year or 13 year, 14 years old, you don't have like the highway coordination, being around cars and stuff every day. So being young and like being in that position, it's a big jump. And yeah, I had to learn it quickly. I struggled with it at first, but then towards like my second or third race, I finally started to understand it. But that sensation of never being around cars on the road or anything, going right into race cars, definitely a weird feeling.
Yeah, absolutely. So that was what, asphalt, like late models or dirt,
Yeah,
both?
so that was asphalt super late models at first. And then I grew up around the dirt world, so I had tons of interest in that. So the next year, I started testing a lot of dirt late model stuff with Clint Smith and Josh Richards. They taught me a little bit of it. Race a little bit, but not a ton. But I just really wanted to go learn it, get some car control. And I wish I would have done more. I think the
Yeah.
dirt side has really shown how big that is now in today's racing. I loved it. I really loved it. But I think if I could have gone back and spent time and, where my parents spent money into it, I probably would have pushed the percentage closer on the dirt side than it was pavement. But it's hard because you map out these deals of how you go and where your budget is, and you have limited time when you're being 13 or 14 getting into it. It's like, okay, I got to push it and get into here at this time, and you create this path that it worked out great. Don't get me wrong, but it's tough when you go, okay, I can only do this. Got to get to here. I didn't want to get trapped into the world of like going down the dirt route when I knew I wanted to go to the NASCAR side.
Right. So when did you kind of, okay, I'm, say to yourself or say to your parents or put together a proposal, like I'm gonna go, I want to go race NASCAR. The obvious route is starting in the K&N series.
Yeah, it's really interesting looking back now because like with my racing now, I'm paying for it, really going for the sponsorship side. But I was fortunate enough back then not to have to worry about it too much. And that's one thing too we can get into later is the drivers with money side of things is very interesting being in that part. So, but to answer this question, I think the at first it was super late models. And then from there was definitely K&N was the step up that made sense. And then from there, I met Kenny Schrader and drove his ARCA stuff for a while. Loved Kenny. What an awesome guy, an amazing mentor. Guy's got a lot of stories.
As you do, yeah.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And that kind of set the stepping stone for some connections into KBM, JGR. He really helped me get into those connections and say, hey, this is somebody who should go try and get in these cars. And so without Schrader, I really don't feel like I ever get my foot in the door into bigger organizations.
Right, because you kind of jumped, like you were in good equipment. I don't know about your K&N stuff, but that first your first truck race was in a KBM truck, like a winning truck. That's a great opportunity. Tell me about that first race, because that must have been like, holy cow, I belong here.
Well, the first race was with BJ McLeod, and so we ran
Oh,
three
okay.
races in that. Yeah.
Okay,
So we
okay.
show up with this truck. It's 2014 in October in Martinsville. And we show up with this completely black truck, no sponsors, just a zero number truck, and that was kind of fitting for it. And the body was beat to hell. It looked like it was about to go into a Martinsville race, like a second feature type thing. Like it was not knocking it, but like there was a lot of new bodies. Like the 2015 bodies were being put on the trucks, and we had like a 2013 Silverado body on
Yeah,
there.
yeah, 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 yeah.
It just been put through the ringer. And if we ran the top 10 most of the race, finished eighth, I remember as high as fifth or something, and it made no sense what we were doing, like in the positions up there. We had a good motor in it, but it was a lot of fun. And this was back in the days when you had tons of NASCAR tech officials. They've let a lot of them go in the years after that. But remember, after the race, we were the random because it
Yeah,
made no
yeah.
sense why we were there. And so we had like tw we have a picture still of like 20 officials around our truck, like trying to see what the heck happened with this truck. Why was it so quick? And but yeah, it was fun because like back then with I guess James Buescher and yeah, Townley, Brandon Jones, Cole Custer, myself, like all kind of in that mix. But a lot of the guys like Brandon Jones, Cole Custer, myself, I think maybe Blaney back then, Austin Terrio, like kind of that time frame. A lot of guys coming up together, and that was a lot of fun to be part of that group.
Yeah, for sure. So I mean, you go out. Okay, I didn't realize that was in that equipment at Martinsville. So you go out and you're like, yeah, I belong here. I can do this. This is, obviously the next step. I'm now in a national series. What does, I guess, the proposal then, to your parents or whatever, look like to do, I guess, a limited schedule?
Well, to be honest, from that point, I really wasn't involved in like the proposal side anymore. Like that was kind of my dad started to steer the ship a bit. So to feel like I belong in that race, and we raced Phoenix and Homestead after that, to say that would definitely be a flat out lie. Like I was
Okay.
just kind of, I feel like I was learning in there, and that's really about where I felt like I was. The ARCA side was going well. But I definitely felt young. I felt like I was gaining experience, but I also felt like I was up against the clock a little bit because between the BKR rides and KBM and the Thor Sports stuff, like seats were filling up quick, and
Sure.
so I wasn't sure where I fit in with their schedules. And a lot of drivers, like I said, in that class are coming in, filling seats, going there. So I met Kyle at Martinsville that weekend. And so my agent Chris Bybee and my dad had the kind of plan, like, okay, where's this going to go? And so talked about maybe doing some stuff with them, and that kind of just served a purpose of like Homestead and Phoenix of getting the licensing checks and stuff needed to go into the next year. And then signed up for the deal over at KBM to start, in my first race with them was at Charlotte in 2015.
Okay. And was that like, it's a serious organization there, right? Like everything's
Yeah.
official. You feel like, as a kid going into that shop and doing those deals, you feel like, oh, this is like, big time. At that point, you had already, I assume, decided like, okay, I'm going for it. I want to be a cup racer.
It was an interesting time with that because I had those aspirations, but at the same point, I was going to UNC Charlotte. I wasn't racing every single week, and I started to feel the disadvantage of that over at KBM. And to be honest, over at KBM, I felt out of place. And the reason I say that is I felt like I had speed, doing very well in the ARCA stuff. I felt like my debut at Charlotte at KBM, I think we finished sixth, ran pretty well the whole night. Gateway went well until I wrecked later on in the race, but had good speed inside the top five. I feel like during that time period, there was a weird mix of things going on because I had moved down, first time being away from home. And I think for me, I wasn't sure how to be in Charlotte and understand being with a race team, what the driver responsibilities are. I remember like the teams would give me the setup sheets and the tape and all that stuff, and I'd watch it. But I think my issue was I wasn't experienced enough to know what I was looking for. So I'd watch the tape. I did all the background work, but I wasn't sure what I was looking for. So it's kind of like drinking from a fire hose. We did the simulator stuff and all that went well. but I wasn't sure what my application was in there of like as a driver, like what am I supposed to do? What am I looking for? I didn't quite know that. And I think that caused some frustration between crew chief and myself. And like, what are we really going here for? What's my job at the shop? Because that was a shared truck. So several drivers going through, Kyle running it, myself running it. And we had some other rotating people in there. So I think I felt a little bit lost in the sauce of what am I supposed to do? I'm going to school, doing this, jumping from ARCA to trucks. And I didn't really find my footing at all. I got a little bit lost in it. And then on top of it, I started to become symptomatic and starting to get the migraine, starting to get all this stuff, some light sensitivity that I later found out was the brain tumor deal. So all of these things are swirling. And although there's good runs and things that happened in there, I don't think I ever eclipsed my, I never got to my potential because I didn't know how to go apply it. And if I had that now and go back in, I'd be like, okay, go do this and go do that. I'd be okay. But that was such a big learning curve. And even in ARCA and late models and stuff, you never had the data and the telemetry and stuff. So while I'd ask, you know, I'd ask people like, okay, how do I go run this track? What do you do? My note taking was thorough, but I just never felt like I could go apply it because I didn't have the track time. So I just felt like I was a little bit confused would be the best way to say it.
Right, right. It is like, I've only driven a truck a handful of times, but it is such a jump and such a different deal and driving style that it's it's so easy to start trying too hard and overdriving those things.
It is. And I think I got so wrapped up in like, what am I doing? Where am I supposed to go? That I quit driving. I just kept thinking. And I got that opportunity in August or September with Gibbs in the 20 car at Kentucky. And I was running second in the race until like 10 to go. Didn't run that well the whole race. I mean, I was like 15th or 20th and then started picking my way up and then kind of figured it out. And it felt like, okay, like maybe we're going somewhere with this. And it felt more like, okay, just relax and go drive. It's a car. And it was easier for me to understand the aero in the car and kind of get that and found ourselves in the top five with like getting close in the race. And then in second, then I completely screwed up the last restart, complete rookie move on that. Like did not do that well at all. But I got in that, I was like, huh, okay, this feels all right. And then got to 2016, doing the part-time deal in the 18 car. And the beginning part of that year, I felt like I'd finally found my footing. I found like Chris Gale, Chris Yurtis and that crew, like we worked really well together. Felt like I had good speed, good repertoire with them. Like just felt like everything was clicking. And you know, that's when the brain tumor deal hit. And I was like, oh, man, like it just kind of fell apart at that. But I felt like I had finally found like what I was looking for in the cars, what I needed in people and chemistry. And after that happened, I feel like I was searching to get like my footing back after the surgery from a mental standpoint. I pushed through. I did okay through 16, but 17, I was lost. And I couldn't figure out why. And I had to meet with a sports psychologist just to get myself like back in the game of, again, the thinking thing, like just overthinking. At 18, I got it back. And what I realized was when I was not having fun with it, I got just overwhelmed. And then I was like, well, he's doing this and he's doing that and he's breaking here. And because this is before SMT where you could just go exactly where it was. So you're kind of guessing a little bit. And I finally got that back in 18 and felt like, okay, I'm good now. But just looking back in my career in trucks and Xfinity, now, like from my Cup experience and my 18 experience, I just really realized that I was trying to do so much where I really just needed to go do my job. And that overwhelming amount of information, I just really needed to focus on what I could be good at and not the stuff that I wasn't good at and just make the most of what I could do.
What were you taking in at school?
So I was in a business management course or going for that degree. Yeah.
Because I feel like what you explained there, that can happen to you're a smart guy. It can happen to smart guys and analytical guys, guys who are engineers and you know, they're stepping outside their role as a driver and really trying to, you know, focus on all sorts of other stuff when they've really just got to drive the car. Take me back to finding out you had a brain tumor. How did you really, like, were you going in for tests and they you know, told you one day, like, was it scary? Was it unknown?
Yeah, I was at Talladega in 2015, and I wrecked in the back straightaway. And I was driving back from that race, didn't fly. And I had hurt my back decently in that race. Not anything terrible, just like soreness and kind of pain. And just sat on it for 7 hours driving back to Charlotte. So, you know, it just compressed the whole time. And getting back to Charlotte, I was like, damn, like this thing really hurts. And so I'd be like on the floor and I couldn't get up without putting my back against the wall and like going up, like trying to just extend up. And it was just a disc issue. So I went in just to get some scans and make sure something wasn't broken or anything like that. And like, no, it's a bulging disc. And like, okay. So I did some PT and it's fine. Then, from that time area of 2015 fall to the spring of 2016, I had these issues where when I would wake up and turn on a light, it would just hurt a lot, like really, really sensitive to light. And then I would have like these weird things at night where I just felt like uncomfortable, like just this odd sensation. I'd have these songs on the radio, this like just sounded really weird, like something just felt off with everything. My sense of smell was getting distorted, and I started just getting a lot of pain to where I was taking like 4 or 5 Excedrins a day, and just like a lot of just pain. And so I raced the Richmond race in the 18 car, and we raced off of turn two. I think I half the field. It felt like off of turn two. And my back started flaring up again. So I went to Dr. Petty, who was the neuro guy and the spine guy over at Carolina Neurosurgery and Spine Associates. And he looked at my back and he's like, hey, you know, you probably got the bulging disc deal. We need to look at this. And I said, hey, can I just go for another 15 minutes and check out my brain and my head just to make sure there's not like long-term concussion issues? Cause I hit some stuff pretty hard over those years. I didn't know what the story would be. And he said, yeah, you know, I think I can go run that through insurance and make sure we can be kosher to do all that stuff. Sure enough, go through the MRI, come out the other side, and there's this mass on the right frontal lobe of my skin. So he said, this may be cellular dysplasia, which is like this mass clumping of cells. It could be a tumor. We're not sure yet. So I said, okay, what do we do about it? Well, I'm going to go bring this to my brain tumor board and we'll reconnect later on. So I just kept on racing for a couple weeks. My mom got a call. She's in the grandstands at Michigan. I'm on the warm-up laps for the ARCA race. And Dr. Petty calls her and says, hey, we need to bring in Matt. Like, we're pretty sure this is a tumor. And she's like, okay, well, you know, we're at Michigan right now. Well, he's not racing, is he? Yeah, they're about to take the green flag. He's like, okay, well, we're not going to make it. Like, we just make sure he doesn't hit anything. And she's like, how can I not make sure? how do I figure that out, you know? And sure enough, that race, like, I got carbon monoxide poisoning or whatever and was, you know, on the oxygen deal after the race. That same time in the Info Care Center on the oxygen deal, there's this guy next to me. And his ears bleeding. Apparently, he got drunk, and they're throwing beer bottles back and forth with each other, and the glass cut off his ear. What's that artist that got his Van ear Gogh. Cut off? Van Gogh. Yeah, so all the doctors are calling, man, you got Van Gogh next to you. And then Van Gogh came up with a box, a little box of his ear in there, and asked me to sign it.
No way. This guy was still drunk. Oh, man.
He didn't know where he was 3 shades of the wind, for sure.
Jeez. But, man, so... carbon monoxide poisoning is no joke. I had a little bit of it the beginning of last year. I was so high after the race. My crew chief was just laughing his ass off. Like, dude, you were talking like nonsense.
It's funny because you have this like sense of what your driver sounds like when he's pissed, when he's sad, when he's okay, and then all of a sudden you hear them like just wrong in the car. Because I've heard it now on the owner's side, like, that don't sound like him. What's up with that?
Yeah, dude. I thought I was a lap down. I forgot to shift up into fourth on a restart, and I finished sixth.
Jeez.
Like, I was that was the first time for that. So they did the surgery and took care of it, and you were out for a little bit, and NASCAR was like, you're good to go?
So we get past the Michigan deal. I come in and I go into the office and he goes, hey, you don't want to sit down for this. I was like, okay. Like, there's no warning of what was going to happen in that meeting there. And so he's like, do you want to have your parents on the conference call? Because, you know, they hadn't been told this before. So I said, sure, let's call him in. And he said, Matt, you know, we looked at everything and we need to do a biopsy because we're pretty sure it's a tumor. And I think my emotions were just so pissed off because I was about to go to Iowa. I liked Iowa. That was a fun track. Like, all I'm thinking is racing. Yeah, that's it. It's just the normal track. And so I was like, well, can we just wait until the end of the season? And he's like, honestly, here's the deal. It could be you wait a few months and this thing grows. All of a sudden you're looking at the cancer situation. It could be we get in there and it's benign, but we got to make sure. He's like, I'm saying recommend, but like, you need to get this thing out now. So that was the beginning of June. The worst part of that was I got the biopsy done. And then Sam Hornish was driving my car that weekend in Iowa, and he won. And that was the weirdest thing ever because it's got my name on there still, the windshield, the driver's door, everything. It's my name sitting in victory lane. I swear that thing haunts me to today. Like, it's so freaking weird. So the biopsy comes back. Call me in again. They said, nah, it's a tumor. So July 1st, I get the tumor taken out. It's a half-dollar size tumor. I don't know if you can see this much. So the scar goes from up here all the way down here to the side, 144 stitches. There's a lot. So there's a 7-hour-ish surgery. And they got just about all of it. And then, you know, afterwards, I realized they like, it was so bizarre. I could smell. I realized how many smells I hadn't smelled in years. The light sensitivity went away, but I'm on these steroids, so I gained like 40 or 50 pounds within a month.
Were you lifting?
Giant. No, I wasn't lifting. I was lifting, but like a thing of like Toll House ice cream or something. And then, going through that period, like my head hurts so bad. I was afraid to kind of go outside and stuff because I didn't know like what the feelings were. Every new stimulant was just a lot for my brain to handle. The craziest thing, though, I remember was taking my phone, putting it up to my ear. You know, like when you have two walkie-talkies and they have that feedback noise? I could feel that in my brain, like the electromagnetic deal or whatever. It was so sensitive, I could feel it, like, reverberating off of there.
Jeez.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but, like, there's definitely something there.
Oh, well, yeah. Phones run off that stuff. There's definitely something there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, it was wild getting back into that period, but then – I went up to Duke and said, how in the world can I get back to racing? Because there's no protocol on this. You know, you have concussion protocols. There's no brain tumor protocol at all. So we went, a lot of the stuff went off of different protocols from pilots and different athletes and different sports leagues. So we figured that going through EEGs, MRIs, and basically trying to make sure everything's clear, electrical activity is good. And then eventually to a neurocognitive exam. So making sure they go through everything, drawing pictures, not my strong suit, but going through all that stuff to make sure I'm as cognitively, there as anybody else on the track. And so they're able to do it. It was the number one and number two neurologist and neurosurgeon in the country giving me clearance to go back. And NASCAR said, okay, go do a test and we can work towards getting me cleared. And so they're, very much in step with all the doctors on that side of things.
Right. So you get back, you're good to go. And do you do a whole other season with Joe Gibbs or do you go to RCR after that?
Yeah, so I ran the entire I ran like four or five more races past that, maybe a few more in 16. Then 17, I ran the full season with those guys before I went to RCR in 18.
Okay. What was the biggest difference between that kind of, Joe Gibbs Toyota deal and RCR? Obviously, they're both, legendary teams, but what was the biggest difference? Was it like, cultural difference or just way about going things or what?
Yeah, I think first off, cultural difference, but that was even true for my team in 16 to 17. Really learning how people work together and going through that for a full season, my first time full season in there. But going to RCR, one of the biggest things I liked about them was they felt like racers. It felt a bit less corporate. It was the go to a Saturday night, drink a beer feel, but in a corporate environment. And I think that was a place that felt fun for me. They believed in me. Not saying JGR didn't, but it just felt like this different. It felt like a different place for me. Randall Burnett was awesome. He's Kyle Busch, the crew chief now, a fantastic crew chief. And I think that was just a place I need to go after everything that happened over the Toyota camp between KBM and JGR, the brain tumor, everything that happened, moving down there. Like, I needed a fresh, clean slate. And that was a great place for me. The biggest difference I would say was Toyota Sim and Pratt & Miller Sim, which is the Chevrolet simulator. That was the biggest thing at the time. But as I was there, they got better and better to where they're closer. But, you know, I think the biggest thing is just how they went about stuff from a top to bottom procedure line of things and how drivers work together with the group and organization, having a voice in it, more of what I wanted the car to feel like, all that kind of stuff was a bit more open for me there. And I think that made me kind of feel like the Schrader days where I could have a, you know, really a say in what happened and how it happened. I feel like we got to build good, consistent runs and build on momentum being there. And it built my confidence a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you ran good there. Let's go back to a little bit of like insider baseball for people who, because it's something that's so secretive. Guys talk like no one really opens up about their deals, and you're kind of outside of it a little bit, mm-hmm. if you don't mind. How does let's take your RCR deal. What does that deal look like? Are you bringing X number of dollars of sponsorship? Do you have, you know, what kind of commitments through the year? Like, how does that get structured?
Yeah, I mean, that's true for all these deals. So every deal I was a part of, basically, I bring money, and then you're allowed to sell X number of races, and then you're paid X amount, and then that's kind of how it works. So for an Xfinity team, I think a good baseline is saying $5 million to $6 million bucks a year is yep. what it costs. 4 to 6 is a good range, depends where you're at now. I know a lot of stuff has changed, but that's still the range. Between sponsorship or OEM help or the driver, that's what you got to bring. And then you have some races you're open. Some of them, they have corporate sponsors that the team has a part of that they have already preset on there. So that's kind of how it goes, but it's a big commitment. It's a big financial responsibility. But even in the Cup side, I mean, you see all these deals come about and somebody's paying the bill. And that's the biggest thing is you can have a driver with money privately. You could have an investor behind them. That happened a lot too. You have family in there. You could have public. It could be, corporate from like Toyota, Chevy, someone like that. But someone's paying that bill to the teams.
Right. Right. Did you have to go out? I guess you mentioned that you had a you had someone helping you there, like a manager. Did you mm-hmm. go out and actively hunt sponsorship during the season? Go into it with a good amount of sponsorship? Like, run me through that.
Yeah. So 16 and 17, not really. Now I had some. I think the team had some offset because of the NOS deal. So we have a NOS car, a few. The NASCAR, NASCAR.
NOS Energy. Yeah.
Yeah. NOS Energy, NASCAR. So I had that for a part of it, but there are open events as well. 17 and 18 was completely wide open. Nothing going into there. So 17, I wouldn't say did much. Tried to help as much as I could from the driver's side, but really public appearances and things like that. The stuff you're supposed to do, dinners, yeah. That kind of deal. But then, you know, towards the middle of 17, you know, we're like, hey, we don't have money for this forever. Like, I got to go start hunting stuff. 18 started to go try to find that with my family. My dad and I really kind of went on that side. I wouldn't say we got a ton at all, maybe a couple hundred thousand at most. So it was privately funded for most of it. And then between 18 and 19, I really started to go more into that and to try and find it. But I wouldn't say that it was much more than maybe six figures across the 3 years, which is tough because it's a big financial burden on the family. Now, they were in a position where they had been fortunate to sell their company and all these things worked out. But without it, I don't think I would have been able to. And really, 19 was like the end of the run of money and things going in there. So at the front row days in the Cup Series, I was really starting to go out and start hunting sponsors and try to get hooked up with things, and had a driver deal to for competition moving forward, like for those kind of incentives to say on the team. But it is definitely, up until that point, you're not getting paid. You're not making money. It is a full investment. And I think that's a weird thing for people, like in the sport, whenever you see a guy make it to Cup, I would say 90% of those people had to pay their way in some form, whether it's their grandpa, their dad, every rich kid you hear about, that's every single driver at this point, unless they've been in there for a bit.
Right. Right. For sure. And at
least I'm guilty too. I'm guilty too.
Absolutely. Like, you know, and going into those seasons when it's like, okay, write the check and now you're committed to the season. You know, someone has to say, okay, push comes to shove, we're paying. You know, however hard you bust your butt and find sponsorship throughout the season and, you know, win the championship or whatever. Was the financial part of the reason that you made the jump to Cup, looking at it like, okay, I can sell more sponsorship at the Cup level. There is more prize money at that level. Was that kind of the impetus?
Absolutely. Yeah, a lot of that. I would have loved to do another season at RCR, but financially it didn't make sense. Not that their prices were outlandish. They actually worked with us a lot. So I love those guys. We still work with them now on the LibFast side. But from the Cup perspective, like when you're in Xfinity, you say, hey, we're selling this NASCAR deal to the Xfinity Series. They say, okay, but when are you in NASCAR? It's like, no, this is NASCAR. Okay, but when are you in NASCAR? Like, okay, that's Sundays. And that's what you deal with all the time. It's like, when are you in NASCAR? So
yep.
To go leverage sponsorship and have B2B deals and do all that stuff, Sunday is the show. Like, that's it. You can make other stuff work. Don't get me wrong. You definitely can. But if you're a brand new brand that doesn't have leverage yet or doesn't have the awareness, they want to be on Sunday. So that part of it, also getting paid as a driver, you know, you're actually able to go make money doing that. And while you still have to have a check written for a good bit of it, you have a chance at getting sponsorship. You have a chance at making a living. And that's where, you know, eventually you can have some of the income offset the cost on there. And then within a couple of years, I feel like you can kind of flip it to where you're either hired or you have a sponsor in there. But that was part of the run-up of all this, was there was an end number. You had to get to it. And once you got there, you know, you had to say, okay, well, the best shot for me to go get funding is in the Cup Series and not in Xfinity anymore. Because really, if you talk to Chef Boyardee and they're on a race car, the CMO knows they're on a race car. But you better have a B2B deal that gives them, between retailers and SKU on their shelves, you better figure that out. Because if they're just on the race car, you can call the CMO and say, hey, we just won the race. And they'll go, what are you talking about? We don't know. And I think that's what gets lost so much. And even for me in my career early on, was the brands are very invested in the sport because it's a marketing wing. But if you're not thinking of it as a marketing wing and you're just a billboard out there, you're lost and you're not going to get another buck, or they're not coming back.
Right. Right. So you make that jump to the Cup Series, I guess, you know, along that same vein, how are you conceptualizing your career at that time? Like, okay, I'm now, how old were you? 23?
Yeah, 22 going on 23. Yeah.
So still like, you know, young enough that it's yeah. Not super, yeah, super pressing, but at a certain point you got to, you know, say, okay, how am I going to make a living going forward? Mm-hmm. And, so that was the route. I'm going to go make a living at Cup, find the money. So you start that season. How big a jump was it to the Cup car?
The Cup car was very different in 2019 because we had the high downforce thing. We had the aero ducts. Like, it was so foreign to, I think, a lot of us. So, you know, before, I feel like the Xfinity car and the Cup car were fairly close, but that year is so different. I think the high horse or the high downforce package was 450 horsepower. So sometimes my rental car had more horsepower than the Cup car I was driving. So that was weird, but the competition level was very fierce. But the biggest problem that I had at first was figuring out how to go figure out aero on restarts and being in the pack, because you'd be underneath somebody and then you get an aero duct intaking all the air, you just shove like crazy up the track. So figuring that out was more like trucks and momentum racing, which I never thought cup racing would be like that. So Xfinity, was a bit more fun to me for a little bit, but then we got better with it, like from a series standpoint, all the drivers figuring that out. And then it was like, okay, the cup series is qualifying laps every freaking lap you run it, and you better be on it. You cannot make a mistake. And for us being at front row, it's always a race to getting the lucky dog or staying on the lead lap, because the way the stages break, you are on the cusp every time. So being in the cup series, there's no mistakes, but you're also chasing lap time. I figured that out very quickly because they're saying, hey, if you're running a 39.80, you need to be at a 40 because the leader's coming at this pace. So that was a big thing, was chasing your own time rather than the track, and then figuring out when and when not to pass because of that system of cars coming so much and so fast, that if you're in 25th, you could be 32nd really quick because you get off cycle on the pit stop or you miss time something and your whole day's done. Although it could be the other side, you're in a 30th, you hit it the right way one time, you take the wave and something works out for you, and you have a late race restart and you're four wide going to a corner at Kansas, you finish 18th. So right. It was just so exact of what you had to be. You had to be so on it. And Xfinity, you could have three mulligans in the race and you're back in the top five at the end, you're good to go. Cup, if you have one mulligan, your day can be screwed.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So you start that season. When does, I guess, your first seizure happen?
Yeah. So it was October.
Or back up if you want, if there's, other things leading up to that, like little hints.
Yeah. No, absolutely no hints. Nothing of, not one deal leading up to it led me to go down that route. Now, looking back, there's some hits, I think, that messed up some things spine-wise and stuff that I've since corrected and understood of, like, what happened. We went to Kansas mid-October of 19, and the week before, I was so sick. I had diarrhea, throwing up. I had food poisoning. I went to my favorite Indian place and got salmonella from raw chicken. Just everything coming out every end. Then the night before, going to Martinsville, for the whole week, I hadn't stomached much more than those like little cheese crackers, like the orange and peanut butter crackers, Lance or something. So hadn't eaten much, down on sleep, didn't sleep well the night before, no electrolytes whatsoever, had gotten some racks that had hurt my spine. And then that morning I go there and I'm about to go out for practice and go up and take off my shoes, come back and make a cup of coffee. And then I just remember I had my tongue just kind of go back and my eyes were rolling back. And I didn't know what was happening. It happened so quick. And I thought in that moment I was just dying. So I'm way down. I'm a believer now, but I wasn't religious back then. And I just remember thinking like, God, just please let me wake up. So it happened. And then later on, I figured out that I had a grand mal tonic-clonic seizure. It was just a perfect storm of electrolytes, lack of sleep, nothing being held in my body, injuries that I wasn't taking care of very well. And, it just was this awful, perfect storm. And so it was terrifying. And then a few months later, I was in Aruba and this horrific one I had there. And that's where I was like, okay, what's really going on here? And that's when I kind of got on medication and things transpired from there to start going on the path of getting better.
Man, that must have been terrifying. Like I'm dying right now. Like
you can't breathe. Like your tongue goes down your throat, basically. Everything goes into a full lock Charlie horse from your brain or your head down to your toes. Like everything goes in one lock and you just fall and you have no control of anything because when you're not on medication for it, like there's no control whatsoever. Like that's its job. But it was terrifying because it didn't make sense. It happened so quick. And really a seizure is like when you have a Christmas tree, the one light starts blinking, they all go out basically. Same deal. So it's all one massive computer. And when one goes out, the whole thing shorts out and it needs an electrical reset. And that's what a seizure is. So one thing I've really learned over these last couple of years is a seizure is not a cause. The seizure is an effect. So you're seeing the reaction of something that's been happening in that moment, a misfire whatever that might be, a misalignment like structurally, and all of a sudden that happens. But it doesn't just happen. There's something that's leading up to that going on. And that's what took me a while to figure out. And then once I did, it started getting better. But man, during them, it's horrific. I never wish that on my worst enemy. I'll say that.
Right. So that took you out of the race season, correct? Right. Yep. Like right after that first one.
Yep.
I mean, I guess how did that feel? Like through no fault of your own, you're just sidelined.
It's very weird. So the week before, I had signed a multi-year extension with an option every year with Front Row. And so I'm like, man, I got it made. Like I just hit this performance requirement every year. Like I can keep on going in the Cup Series. Like I finally made it. You know, we won't have to spend any more money doing this. But I can start paying back my family doing this stuff. Like, wow, I finally did it. Because I carried a lot of guilt with that. Like it's a weird thing because, you know, you try and make it, your parents help you, you do all that stuff. But I don't want to be just somebody who is munching off of them. Like, no, that sucks. You know, going from going to practice and literally a half a second later, you're on the ground and then, you know, later on being in the medical center and then the hospital. I think you realize how quick this stuff can go away and be taken from you. I think also it makes it to where for me, I didn't know who I was, you know, going for all this time trying to be a race car driver. It's what you're doing. It's who you are. You identify with that. Like there's nothing else that you want to be, which is kind of a problem, I think, a little bit. But you're in the top series of the sport. You have to live, eat, and breathe it. That's what you do. So when it was gone, it was scary. I didn't know what I was going to do. Luckily, I had some savings. And so 2020 starts, and you know, still fighting medical things. And I go into that year still lost, not knowing what to do, if I could do some PR or marketing, whatever. And then COVID hits. So it's just this weird time. But the COVID thing, I'll be honest, like while it was lonely and all that stuff, NASCAR being on pause helped me like kind of just reset myself to where I was like, okay, what can I do? What can I like kind of zoom out and look at big picture? And Live Fast was one of the things that came of that from the ownership side. But yeah, it's just it's scary how when you are aligned so closely with one thing, it's taken away that fast. Like it's depressing. It was very anxiety inducing. I felt like I was useless. I didn't know what to do. And I had just gotten married a few months before then. And, you know, that was falling apart because of all this shit going on. And, you know, eventually that led to a divorce. And so all this stuff is rolling around, like with COVID and losing a job and, you know, a marriage coming apart and all this stuff. It's like, what is my life? You know, like what is going on?
So you said that you found faith and it was during that time. Is that, were you kind of searching around and take me through that journey?
Yeah. Very interesting journey. So I wouldn't say it happened right away. So I would say during that time period, I was definitely lost, definitely curious about like, you know, finding purpose. And I felt very empty all the time. So I, you know, I had had like just an exploration of like all kinds of cultures and spiritual things and all this stuff, trying to find like, what makes sense? What's the bigger purpose here? Like, I thought my purpose was a race car drive and realized that ain't it. So, I like it, but that's not the entire thing of life. So, it left this piece of emptiness, and I tried to find so many things and, through therapy and like all this, I went down all kinds of rabbit holes of like, what's the meaning? I think it was sometime after my divorce that I talked to Blake Cook, and he was like, hey, you know, I said, like, I know, you know, you've gone to faith over your life and you're very much a believer. Like, what is God? Who is God? What is this whole thing? What's Christianity? No idea. Didn't understand. Michael McDowell. I was like, man, how do you look at this? What is it? Because I didn't get it. I didn't understand it. I'll be honest, I thought it was stupid. Like I thought it was dumb. I realized now that I was dumb, but I think it took those hard conversations with myself to go, can we just put our ego aside for a minute to maybe think you're not the center of the world, that things are bigger around you. So, I ended up getting divorced, like I said, shortly before I met my now wife, Jordan. I started just like wondering, okay, should I go listen to some podcasts and watching sermons on YouTube? And so we got together and both of us were in that explorative phase. And so we went to church one day, just said, you know what, this Sunday, let's just go to church. I'd never done that. I don't think I'd been to church willingly in my life, maybe for a wedding, but that's it. Hey. And it wasn't the church for me, but I was like, hang on, the scripture in here is really speaking to me. And while this might not be the church for me yet, I want to find more of this. And so we went to a bunch of churches and eventually found the church we went to. Finding our church home at is 2 minutes down the road from our house. We love our pastor, Pastor Joel there, the Watermark Church here in Troutman. And it just was an incredible experience of like feeling God, knowing that there's a bigger purpose. But I think the big thing for me too was I felt this void, and there wasn't between like, you know, normal vices, and I was on benzodiazepines and trying to get off of those. And there wasn't a gap that filled that would fill it like God would. And so feeling that community, the grace in there, being able to forgive myself and others and everything that happened in there was so amazing. And I think I would not go back to racing now or do what I do if it wasn't for a bigger purpose of helping people, inspiring people, doing it for God, and knowing that there is not just because of it's me, you know, like before it was just Matt. Now it's like, okay, there's a big picture here, and I'm still very new into it. But you know, I'm exploring, more and more into, you know, finding some youth groups and my church family. But, we got baptized, this year, and we got married at the church, and it's just been so special. And so fulfilling. And sometimes I'm like, man, I need to get back into this week, or I kind of fall away from it and I get back into it. So I'm trying to be better with that. I know I'm not the best Christian yet, but I'm trying to be. But that's been a really special journey.
Yeah. That's, do you listen to Jordan Peterson?
Yeah. Yep.
So you and him both coming off of the benzos there.
Oh man, the benzo deal is awful, because I got put on the benzos, after my second seizure, I believe. And they said, here's clonazepam. Go take this and it'll help you calm down, chill out. And it did. It was amazing. It was like, wow, this feels like a warm hug. It's like, oh, it's okay. Then that was maybe 0.25 milligrams of it. And then 2 weeks go by. I didn't know you're only supposed to be on it for 2 weeks. My doctor didn't tell me. Then I said, hey, you know, you can take a bit more. Go to half milligram. And same thing a couple months later. Hey, it's not working so well for me anymore. That's fine. Here's a milligram. So I'm just going off my doctor's recommendation. You know, I'm listening to my doctors, doing what I should be doing.
Right.
And here I go 3 years on this crap, needing it for a crutch with everything I do. If I'm going to go to a restroom, they go take this little pill. If I'm on pit road at, you know, Daytona, watching my car go qualifying, this little thing. It became such a pill grab to go feel okay. I didn't realize it was an addiction until I was in Vegas last year in October, and we're at the Marquee Day Club. And I remember sitting there and just looking around going, I have no idea what I'm doing here with like this medication. It's making me feel depressed, spacey, feel like crap. I just felt so unlike myself. And so then I tried to get off of it. Dude, I'm telling you, this shit to get off of these benzos is horrific. It is horrendous. The side effects of it, of hallucinations, tremors, twitches, the constant need to be going for a pill. I mean, you talk about weird body feelings and anger and irritation, all this stuff. Your whole central nervous system has just been snowed out by this stuff. So it can't comprehend what's going on because it's being just muted. It's like putting a muffler on a car. Like it can't roar all the way. It's just here. So when you take that away even from 3 milligrams to 2.75 milligrams, it's like we need to go here, but it's going way up here because it has no idea how to regulate anything anymore. So I got off of it, and through that period, I was like, okay, I think we're in homestead. I said, I'm going to get off this crap by Christmas. I did it. It was awful. And then it took me about 3 months from like Christmas to March to start feeling okay, just from a like everyday standpoint, because I'd have extreme anxiety attacks, panic attacks, all this stuff. Not because I was going through it personally, but because the medicine was making me feel like this. And in that time frame too, from last year till now, I haven't drank at all. I've been completely sober with that because the Klonopin works on the GABA receptors.
Yeah, and same so, receptor, right?
Yeah, so alcohol does the same thing. And I'm like, man, I can't do that either. So it's been a really amazing journey to feel being an adult and not drinking, because it makes you realize what you do like doing and what you don't like doing, what you need that for social situations for and what you don't. I'm not saying I'm going to be like that forever, but it's been a really interesting journey to feel that and have to force yourself to go through it. But I'm so thankful I'm off of that, because they just prescribe it. And I asked the doctors to give me a plan to get off, and they're like, no, we can't do that. So I had to go find the, I think it's the Ashton manual, and do it myself.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you have any inkling during those 3 years that, hey, you know, and I assume you hadn't been addicted to anything before. Did you have an inkling that, okay, I'm dependent on this stuff? Or was it, I'm dependent on this stuff, but it's okay?
I think it may be the latter, maybe saying it was okay. But when your neurologist says, keep taking it, and also, hey, here's your new prescription, we're bumping it up, you trust them. I mean, who was I to say, no, I shouldn't be doing this? Like, I trusted them for the medication. I trusted them for the stuff I didn't know was wrong. And so I just kept on doing it. And
right.
If it was an opioid type thing where like, oh, they won't prescribe it to me, but like, I need this, you know, I felt like, oh, that's different. But really, is it that different?
Sure. And I guess from my understanding, that is the hardest shit to get off of.
It's so bad because you have this dependence. It's like when you're at home and somebody's on their phone looking at TikTok, you know their brain's getting filled with dopamine the whole time. That's what it is. Our whole society is dopamine. Well, when you're on benzos, you're so muted. It's like, everything's calm. Then it starts waking up. It's like waking up a beast because it can't regulate. So you're like, oh, crap, need that to calm back down. And then you just keep going through this. So as you get off of it and wake it back up, your nervous system can't figure out how to process food. Your IBS like stuff goes way up. Your digestive is messed up. Your muscles hurt. Everything twitches. You hallucinate. You feel all these things that you should not feel as a human being. Like, I've never felt that before. But you know, you do that, but the doctors won't help you. Like, there's no deprescribing. It is an epidemic. It is a big problem. And it's becoming to where I think 2 months ago, they're saying people are not being given Xanax or Ativan. All these things have shortages because the FDA is looking at, can we be giving this amount of people these drugs in the quick candy amount it is? Because you walk into a doctor's office, you say, hey, I got anxiety. Okay, here you go. Just take this, so I'll be fine. And it is until it's not. And they're only made for short-term use. They can be okay for a tool, but being a dependent thing every day, they're not made for that. But the doctors are just saying, here you go, keep on taking it. And I have many big things with medications and stuff that I have some problems with, but that is the biggest one.
For sure. So you weaned yourself off of it just on your own at home, kind of without, you know, with YouTube as an aid?
Well, so it's the Ashton manual. So it's a rehab clinic, and they have a full thing about how to taper, going to different medications and getting off of it. So it's like, you know, you have a protocol. It's a full protocol on there of how to do it. And so I was able to do it that way. But, you know, one of the fears for me was going off of it, you know, there's risk of seizures and stuff like that, because it's also that kind of a tool as well for medication. So that was really wild to me of how exacting we had to be measuring it. Some people do a liquid taper. Fortunately, I wasn't on enough to have to do that. But the one day I realized that I was addicted to it completely was in the amounts. my wife had gotten LASIK. They gave her a bunch of Ativan to knock her out for that day because you're supposed to, like, it's their deal on it. And she is knocked out for like 12 or 14 hours that day. Like, it looked like it was on horse, it looked like she was on horse tranquilizer or something, like how knocked out and gone she was. And then I did the conversion on that. And I realized that the amount they gave her that knocked her out the entire day was less than I took every single day.
Holy cow.
Yeah,
Because I guess you
that
build
was scary.
such a tolerance to it. Just like alcohol, you can build up a big tolerance. Man, oh
Exactly.
man.
Yeah.
So, you're off that, and then what have you done to, and have you been able to, I guess the answer is yes, control the seizures. What kind of,
Yeah.
I'm sure it's a fairly holistic deal.
Yeah. So, big thing at first is, the very first thing is medication. So, medications I'm on, they had to work at for a while to get the right cocktail. Unfortunately, anti-epileptic drugs are kind of that deal. So, I'm on two of them that control them every day. But, I'd say they're great at what they do, but they're a bit of a band-aid because they're not going down to the root cause of things. Like, they're just making sure nothing from calcium and sodium channels, they're inhibitors there, so they help block the regulation and control the flow of all the neurons. But the biggest things have been making sure I get enough electrolytes because that was the big problem for the first one and a few others in there. And then the largest thing to me has been my C1 and my C2, my upper cervical misalignment. Getting that fixed has been insane. So upper cervical care, not typical chiropractic care, but that's been the thing that's been able to get me back on the road, driving back into a race car, and just feeling a lot better every day. The amount of work that's been put into that to correct all these problems up here, get my spinal curve back, do all that stuff has been so huge. It's not a typical chiropractor. It's a completely specialized care. But the effectiveness of that has been absolutely incredible.
So, jumping back to the racing, run me through the thought process of I'm 24 years old, I'm going to buy a cup team.
Yeah, that's a weird statement when you say it like
Yeah.
that. I had always been interested in cup ownership. Even when I was driving, it's like, hey, well, maybe not cup, but NASCAR ownership. Thought when I retire one day, I'd love to go own a cup team. I didn't think I'd retire so quick.
Right.
But there was an opportunity that I saw in the market and had talked about it with my agent before, and that was, the next gen car was coming. These charters were had some value to them. People bought them for $1 million at first, but there seemed to be some value in having them, keeping them around, and then maybe could they grow? Don't know, but there could be something there because we see in other sports and sports franchise all of a sudden we're jumping in value at this time. And thought, okay, well, if I have these savings and have this business interest, could I go get something together to go buy a team? And purely from an investment standpoint, it was a great thing to go look at. But also, I wanted to have some, I guess, I wanted to have to be a stakeholder in the industry still. I didn't want to be away from racing. I love racing. Eat, sleep, and breathe it still. But if I couldn't drive, I wanted to go work in it. And that was the best place I found in my head that could be, hey, this is an important job. It could be an important role. And this is still probably the next best thing to being a driver.
Right. So, I guess explain to me and the listener the charter system, because you hear guys talking about it more and more and more.
Yeah. So there's basically, if you go back to the 2000s, and up to, I guess, until the charter system was put in, there's 40 to 43 cars, depending on the year. And they would get paid an amount to go start the race. But now there's 36 charters. So franchises like NFL has 32 teams, MLB 30, something like that. Like they're close to that. But in NASCAR, there's 36 charters, so 36 teams there total. But there's 40 starting spots. So there can be four open spots per race. The Daytona 500 is really the only race that you see that will get extra cars to come in. But otherwise, the reason you don't see it very often is because The purse for the chartered cars is much higher. You have a guaranteed pay based off your historic value. That's a whole rabbit hole of it's based off an average of the last 3 years, and it's a mess. But your chartered car is guaranteed in the race. That's the biggest thing. So it allows you to be in the race guaranteed no matter what happens. If you miss qualifying, you're going to be in that race. That's the biggest thing of it. But also, it's a one of 36. So it gives it a value in there. So if you go back to when Barney Visser sold Furniture Row, when he sold it, he sold sheet metal, he sold cars, but there's no value for that team other than that, and maybe infrastructure. But there's no value for those assets or that the fact that they had a team. When you sell the Cleveland Cavaliers, it's going to have a price tag with it. So NASCAR kind of adopted this of, hey, here's a charter system. It's a revenue sharing model. It allows them to have a bit of a seat at the table, at least a small piece of the pie, to go into the entire league.
Now, you hear, and you don't hear it anymore. You hear back in the day, okay, there's these start and park teams. They're just, they're trying to get the money that is paid out just to start the race, and they're trying to use as little equipment as possible and, not put new brakes on it, not run with new tires and make their money that way. Can not using that term, but can a team still do that with the charter system? Can you show up and make money every weekend keeping your costs low, or is that, or are you not even close?
Well, the start and park deal kind of went away when they enforced the 100% rule. So years before the Chargers came about, they said, hey, if you're going to show up at the track, you got to be at 100% effort. When they went past them, went to the charter system, the next gen car was really the answer to that problem of the certain park cars. Because when we came in 2021, I think we finished like an average of 28th, and we didn't have a giant budget, but we were still trying. We've never been a certain park team. We've always tried. We just had less resources. But enter the next gen car. Millions of dollars of investment and capital to put in, get into these cars, which is great. Like from a conceptual standpoint, it was going to put everyone on the same playing field. What that did was the start and park cars could no longer be that because you have to be at some level to go do it. Because before you'd have Hendrick spending, I'm not saying Hendrick, but like an example of any big team spending 35 to 40 million and a tiny team spending maybe one or two as a start and park. That is gone, like absolutely gone. So now you have everyone close to the same speed. I think we were at Martinsville in the spring. And every car in on the track ran the same lap time within 1/10 of a second. Like insane. So that's been the big change is having parity across the field. Now you're still going to have the big guys rise up. The motor costs are still high. But overall, the field is much, much closer. R&D, engineering, you're always going to have those splits. But it eliminated the very, very small guy. The little guy, us, is still here. But the tiny guy is no longer there because they can't come in, start and park, get out because that position is just gone. And really, the 37th through 40th place points are placed there. The amount of money that they pay before is not enough for them to come out and go just start and park. Like the jump from an open car to a chartered car for a purse paid per weekend is a giant leap, and only the Daytona 500 and a few other races is it really worth it to come out and try to make money doing that.
So what is the, I guess the long term, I'll let you go soon, but what is the long term plan with Live Fast there? How do you, what's your 5-year plan, 10-year plan with the team?
Well, I think first off, the biggest thing from day one to now has been trying to grow it. So when the next gen deal came about, we spent millions in trying to up our program, trying to get the cars, make everything really nice. So we did that. The problem was the cars we ran with from 28 to 36, they all went away. So then we're kind of on our own island. So we didn't get worse from an investment standpoint in 22. We just got worse in the fact that our running position got worse because we didn't have that class, the C class of cars to be with anymore. So we were it, maybe a couple other cars in there, but not many people. So going from last year to this year, we switched from Ford to Chevy. And that allowed us to have better motors with the ECR alliance we had. Step up some. Now, it's not kidding anybody. We still are a small team. We can't run with the big guys every single week, but we have moments where we can go do it in road courses, super speedways. Those are where we can go try to make an impact on there with more of an effort. But, you know, I think the thing for us is trying to be more competitive week to week. But, you know, at the same time, it's no secret that in the rumor mill in the market, like, people are talking about these crazy prices with charters. And, you know, that's always something that we're being, you know, hit up and talked to about. But I think the big thing is just looking at, you know, how do we become a more successful team? And is that from a week-to-week standpoint of bringing different drivers? You've seen Anthony Alfredo, Sheldon Creed, Josh Palicki come into our car. Is that with one person for the entire year? So we kind of run up those different scenarios. In a perfect world, I would love to be in a spot where it's one car that can develop people into, you know, bigger spots and be part of a system. But it's so hard to do that, have the right alliance and have the right funding. So really in that 5-year plan, you got to have funding to do what you want to do to make the next jump to being 25th place.
Right. So what's your day-to-day with the team like?
So my biggest thing is I work on the business development side for the sponsorship. So between our partnerships, acquiring, maintaining, doing marketing campaigns, putting all that stuff together, that's what I do. I love it, very passionate about it. And then a little bit on the competition side, sometimes I'll chime in on stuff, making sure we're looking at our budget. And then kind of odds and ends. So working on our plans with our PR girl and Cora on the social media side. And then just, you know, little things we get done, like just inventorying things. What are we buying? It's just kind of a hodgepodge of things outside of that. If we're doing licensing things, it's me. So all that is a bit random. Some of the team presidents stuff, we're going to NASCAR meetings. So it's a bit here and there because we don't have many people at our team. BJ, I end up kind of taking these random roles. But my biggest one is the BD side.
Right, right. You got back in a late model pretty recently. Mm-hmm. How did that come about? What was kind of the plan? How, I guess, what did they, what were your requirements as far as like seizures go? How, like, run me through that.
Yeah. Well, first off, from the seizure side, I've been fortunate enough to not have them for years now. So several years of nothing going on. So that's been awesome. Then going to get doctor clearance of like, hey, can I go do this? And they said, yeah, you know, you can go do this. So that was step number one. And then step two was, do I want to go do this? You know, like I had to sit there and think like, okay, I did this before and I'm a new Matt, you know, do I want to go do this again? And for me, the answer was yes, because I wanted to go do it for myself. Yes. But also because I knew that when I didn't get to hang up the helmet for myself, like I didn't get to choose that, I wanted to go back and just do it. And this was talking about the test, really. So like, let me just go see how it is. And so I did it and it was awesome. Had a great time. The first day was a bit shaky with inconsistency. The speed was there. Second day, speed was there. Everything was great. So then I was like, huh, okay. Should I go do this for myself? And I thought, you know what? No, it's not for myself. I'm planning on having a family here. My wife and I are currently going through some, you know, I'm planning towards that side. And so if my 3 or 5 year plan is having kids and doing all this stuff here, I would love to go do it for my family, for inspiring people, doing all this stuff. And I thought, you know what, put all my thoughts and fears and stuff aside, I need to go do this for something else other than me. And so I went up there, I enjoyed the crap out of it. It was great going to Wisconsin, running a late model. The biggest thing was being there and qualifying that night there on Saturday, the first night, sitting there and like just having, you know how it is, just like the jitters, like, you know, that kind of a deal. Just taking that breath and then going to lay down a lap. I had forgotten that feeling of how intense qualifying is, like being put on the spot and doing it. Like the race is what it is. Like you have your nerves and you got your excitement and your butterflies, but man, qualifying is so exciting. Like I forgot about that.
Yeah, qualifying is awesome. And yeah, just here's your lap. Go do it or screw it up.
Right. It's all on you, right? I mean, like how many times have you sat there? You're just going, okay, I got to go do my job. Like it's just, it's such a weird feeling. And maybe you can like kind of describe it too. Because for me, it feels like it's the show is on you, the light's on you, and you got to go perform. And it's so weird because when you fired up and you get in the back straightaway from pit road to there, you're good. But sitting there on pit road, like, it is, it's everything going through your mind. You're going through, you close your eyes and you're going through the lap in your head a million times. Like, I don't know if you feel like that, but for me, I'm like playing the lap out and making sure I visualize it. But it's a lot in those couple minutes waiting to go out.
It's one of the most enjoyable feelings I get in racing is that qualifying, like, you know, mm-hmm. short of like running in first or second on the last lap. Yep. It's qualifying for sure.
It is. It really is. So I feel like that was, I'm thinking about the race and man, I want to get back to racing and I forgot how cool that part was. So that was a nice little add on through the weekend of like, oh yeah, we like this.
Yeah, that's good. That's good, man. I'll let you go. I know you got to run, but, I ask pretty much everyone, for some advice, that you can give and you've been through the ringer a little bit with, you know, with the benzo stuff, with the seizures, with, you know, having kind of your life path just taken from you. What kind of advice do you give, you know, I guess young people who are looking for meaning in their life?
All your passion. That's the biggest thing. You got to be able to sit back and know who you are. And if you don't know what that is, because I didn't for a while, what do you like? You know, if you like reading, do you want to be an author? Do you want to read books and have a book club about it? Find that passion, because in those circles, you'll find bigger meaning. And then you get to zoom out and out and out. And that's how I found God, was like just being able to zoom out far enough to get past my own little bubble to go find what there really is meaning in life. And, you know, really having something so amazing from an athletic standpoint that was taken away, you realize that you're not one thing. So that passion may be books, it might be drawing, but you're also so many things. So I think finding within yourself who you are, writing down good traits, what you like to do, but then not being afraid to go to try new things and explore new things. I've been a lot more open-minded about the world and life, and I had to force myself to do it, because when you're in this box for 12, 15 years chasing the dream, you don't see a lot of other things in life between travel and foods and whatever it is. So I think finding those little moments, really enjoying them, finding friend circles in there, being open to hearing people. But then I actually think there's a bit of a different side of that too, is you can have that stuff, but set up boundaries for yourself too. Being able to say, you know what, I'm going to explore this stuff, but it's okay if I don't like something. I can say no to this. I can say no to that, and I like the things I like, and become who you really are, because then it starts to mold you. And that's when it becomes really cool, because you say, you know what, I am a race car driver. I am this stuff. I am a team owner. I love what I do. And you know what? I'm not somebody who likes to go to clubs. I'm not. So is that okay? Yeah, it's all right. But does that fit with anybody or everybody? No. And then your circle of people starts to change. And that's when you really find the pure happiness of not mass quantity, but quality of people. And I think that's been a big maturation process for me.
Yeah, that's a great answer, man. Appreciate you coming on. Tell the people where they can follow your team and follow you guys for the rest of the season.
Absolutely. Yeah. So the team's at Team Live Fast, and then for myself is at Matt_TIFFT on all socials. And I try to post some, but I need to get better with that. But you know, we're racing every week and lots of good, cool stuff coming up for the rest of the 23 season and going into my personal life and stuff in 24. So yeah, really appreciate you having me on here.
Yeah, it was good. It was good. Thanks, man. Cheering you guys on.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
That was Matt Tift. I'm going to close this podcast by reading his Instagram caption on his post about coming back to racing. I'm not even sure where to begin. This was a moment I'd never thought I'd feel again. 2019 was a terrible marker of the last time I ever got to do this, and clearly not on my own terms. Not sugarcoating it, it's been hell. Going to the Cup Series, having a seemingly planned out career, all changed in an instant. A combination, personally, between the seizures, going through a divorce, feeling lost and alone, and unable to do the thing that I love most was what was most terrifying. I thank God for a second chance at love, a chance to get to know Him, and this moment working with my doctors, neurologists, and so many others who have helped me overcome hurdles in this journey to even making this possible. I'm so grateful for my friends, my family, my incredible fiance, my race team, and everything that I get to be a part of. The chance to sit down in a race car again and turn some laps was a moment I'll never forget. While I work with doctors to get clearances at different levels, don't expect me to be in NASCAR anytime soon. I know you'll ask, but I'm looking forward to wherever this takes me. Peace.